I also have to just, before I begin, I just have to share that at the unpacking that we, or not unpacking, but the talk that we had before the 10 o'clock hour, I find it really interesting, Leslie, that you shared a story. She shared this beautiful story about her daughter wanting a dog when she was still living with Leslie. And her daughter, and saying no, and then her daughter getting a petition signed by all of her middle school friends and teachers. And now she's telling us the story about her dog, and I just found that beautiful. So before we begin, I'd like to just take a moment to settle in. If you're comfortable, close your eyes or soften your gaze. In the space of quiet, take the deepest breath that you've taken all day, in through your nose and out through your mouth. May the words that I share and the meditations of all of our hearts shine light on the sacred worth of all the more than human creation with whom we share this planet. May it be so. You may breathe your eyes open. So first of all, happy St. Patrick's Day. I'm wearing my green. I see a lot of festive folks in there. But do you know that March 17th is also the feast day of St. Gertrude of Neville, someone I'd never heard of until yesterday, and she is the patron saint of cats. She doesn't get much publicity, but I thought I'd add her into our festivities today. Thank you to Valerie. I'm not sure where she is right now. There she is. Thank you. Thank you to all of you for this lovely invitation to come share some time and space with you this morning and tell you a little bit about what it is that I do. Before I came today, I spent some time looking at your website, learning a little bit more about the community, and listening to meditations from some of you. I love that practice of getting to know each person. Everyone has got so much wisdom to share, and it's just lovely to have someone do that each week. I thought it might be helpful for me to do a little bit of that with myself, to share how I got to this place of animal chaplaincy. What the heck is that? And answer the question, or not answer it, explore the question, do animals have spiritual experiences? When I use the word animal today, I am talking about the more than human animals, because as you know, we are also animals. But just to clarify that, I won't just keep saying more than human animal. It's too much of a mouthful. So my father was a fighter pilot in the Air Force, and so we lived on Air Force bases. We moved every 2 years. This was a time when the military did that. Are there any folks that were military brats or served in the military here? Okay. So at that time, they were moving families every 2 years. And so my spiritual journey began in the Air Force, in base chapels, mostly in the United States, but we also spent time in Germany and Spain and England. And what happens on base chapels is at 10 o'clock, there's a Catholic Mass, and then if you time it right as a Protestant, as our family was, you get there just before 11 and get to witness an ascension every Sunday, because the crucifix would rise into the rafters and a Jesus-free cross would drop down for our service. And so that, when people say, how did you grow up? I just say, I'm an Air Force Protestant. That's the best I can do. So in 1974, I was about 10 years old, and we were stationed at Nellis Air Force Base in Las Vegas. That's the home of the Thunderbirds, for any of you who've ever seen the formation team fly. We lived in base housing, and the elementary school was in walking distance of our home. One morning, I'm walking to school and I see a bag in a bush that's moving, a grocery bag. And so I went over, investigated, and it turned out it was a bag full of newborn kittens. And so I did what I think any kid would do. I took the bag with me and went right to the nurse's office at the school. The nurse had a reaction that stays with me today. She's like, "Why did you bring these here? I'm going to go call your mom." And I remember feeling like this shame that I couldn't identify, like I did something wrong. And mind you, this was like 3 years after the release of Karen Carpenter's song, "Bless the Beasts and the Children." So it just didn't fit. I thought, wow, that just seemed like the place you'd go with newborns, to a nurse. So that was really my first experience with selective empathy, which has been sort of the bane of my existence ever since, in terms of trying to understand it. Throughout my childhood, I found strays. I would bring them home. I feel like we had a lot of dogs named Brandy. I don't know, because oftentimes we'd leave a place and we weren't able to leave with the dogs, especially when we moved overseas. And so, so we always had a dog or two in our home. In 1984, I was a junior, so we're now moving along in life, at the University of Florida. I was actually studying economics at the time, which is funny to me now and even funnier to my husband, who will joke with me, "Here's the Wall Street Journal, you want to read it?" And no. So I needed to squeeze a two-hour elective into my schedule to graduate, and I found a class called Contemporary Moral Issues. And if the University of Florida is just a few miles away from Stark, which is where the home of the electric chair. And so at that time, that class, there was a section of that class that would be talking about the death penalty, and so that's why I signed up. But Spirit had other plans. Mid-semester, we read a book called Animal Liberation by Peter Singer. He's a philosopher out of the Carolinas area, and he just re-released that book, a 50-year later version of that book, to say, where are we now? That changed my life trajectory in profound ways. Even during that semester, I became a vegetarian, just horrified at what I learned about factory-farmed animals. I'm now vegan and have been for 31 years. I just got a thumbs up for that. Yay. So a couple of years after college, I decided, I think I want to be an animal protection lobbyist in Washington, D.C. So I applied to law schools and wrote my applications, including information about why I wanted to be a lawyer, that I wrote about the debeaking process for factory farm chickens, and I think I closed with, I quoted Ralph Waldo Emerson's poem that's entitled Success, but there's a line in there that's, success means having lived in such a way that one life breathed easier because you lived. And I have always been a dreamer, and I thought, that sounds like what I want to do. What I didn't do, because I don't look into things too much and oftentimes just dream away and head that direction, was look into whether or not an animal protection lobbyist would even need a law degree, which is not the case. And secondly, if there were even any animal protection lobbyists. Mind you, this was 1988, and the answer is no, there were none. I found that out only after my first year, and first year of law school is really the toughest, and I thought, well, as long as I'm here, I guess I should finish this. So that's what I did. So during the after the first year of law school, I actually had an opportunity to work for a group called the Farmed Animal Reform Movement, FARM, an organization out in D.C., and I applied for a thing called a student-funded fellowship from Notre Dame. And what that meant is that students who were going to work for law firms and make the big bucks during the summer could dedicate or donate a day, pledge a day of their pay for that summer job, and put it into a pot for folks who were going to work for nonprofits. And so I applied for a student-funded fellowship and was awarded that, and then the administration pulled it from me, finding that animals don't have souls and this would not benefit humanity. It was, what struck me as odd is that they had let me into the university, and it was pretty clear where I was headed with this, so it wasn't a surprise. I did fight back, and the students fought back with me, and I ultimately was awarded that fellowship to work in DC that summer. I worked in particular on the issues of humane transportation and slaughter for farm animals across state lines. So that's what I did that summer. I also, in that summer, lived in a group home or community. It was like a commune kind of thing, where the address of it was 10101, and the zeros were peace signs. So we lived in this space and worked in this space, and it was a pivotal time in my life in terms of just knowing this is exactly what I want to do. I'm not sure how it's going to work out, but we'll see about that. After law school, I worked for a couple national animal protection organizations, and then I came back. My family is from West Michigan, and so I came back to the Grand Rapids area and worked for a law firm, and they allowed me to continue to do animal law, which was such a blessing. Since then, for the last 25 years or so, I've had my own firm, and so I continue to do that kind of thing. But it wasn't long after I got back, especially into private practice, that I realized that there are all these discretionary loopholes with animal, I'll give animal cruelty is a great example of that. So if you see something terrible happening and you call the police, the police are the first line of discretion. They can choose to either do something about it or not. If they decide to take it up, the next stop is the prosecutor's office, and the prosecutor, too, has discretion to determine whether or not someone's going to be charged. If the prosecutor charges someone, then the next step is the courts. Will they take it up? And will the courts sentence folks based on the guidelines that are provided in our anti-cruelty statutes? What I saw was a lot of that not happening. So I'd spent a lot of time, months sometimes, working on legislation, only to see it not applied. And so I knew then that the only way, and really there were some places where folks I thought I would hit it, we'd get lucky. I remember once I walked into a judge's chambers and she had a life-size statue of her golden retriever in her office. And it was one of those moments like, oh, this is our judge, you know. So it happened periodically. But what I thought is what really needs to happen here is we need to transform. I need to work on transforming hearts. How can I do that? Because I thought that's what I was doing. But the legal system is very limited with respect to that. And so I thought, well, maybe what I need, again, not really thinking it through too much, but thinking maybe I need to go to seminary. That seems like a great place to learn how to transform hearts. And at the same time, I was at part of a United Methodist church, and I thought, yeah, maybe if I was ordained as a United Methodist pastor and had those credentials, then I'd be even more effective at transforming hearts. At my first seminary, a United Methodist seminary in Evanston, I took a worship service class where we had to create and officiate a funeral. And I asked at that time if I could do a family dog funeral and was told no. Which reminded me of the nurse story again. I'm thinking, wait a minute, this doesn't make sense. Without going into too much detail, I'll just share that not long after that, I was on my path to ordination and was unceremoniously Stripped of my ordination certification and membership in the United Methodist Church for officiating a gay wedding. And so I left the church at that time thinking, I'm not sure I'll ever go back to any kind of organized faith community. Although this one, I'm telling you, this is awesome. And went back to refocusing my efforts on what can I do within my legal practice. And so one of those things that I do on the regular now is, because this I can control, is help people with planning for their animals in the event something happens to them, which a lot of folks don't think about until it happens, and I've had enough instances of that. So that's one of those lovely things that I can do with my law degree that is gentle and not indiscretionary. But 4 years ago, I found my way back, still feeling really called to this heart transformation work. And I returned to a seminary, an interfaith, interspiritual, interspecies seminary in New York called One Spirit. And so that is how I'm ordained. I found that through, I'm not sure if you all remember Sal Sapienza. Sal was my pastor at the time, and he said, you know, I went to faith, there was another interfaith seminary in New York that he had attended, and he said, I think you ought to look at One Spirit, and it was home for me. This seminary allowed me to design and officiate an animal funeral, and so things have been looking up since. I wanted to share this. I'm going to just put this down for a second. So this is the stole that I had made by an Etsy artist, and it's really special to me. I gave her the animals that I wanted on it, and they're all here for a reason. Each one of them is a group of animals that at some point in my law career I advocated for. And so, obviously, there's your chicken from the beginning, the application. I worked at one point to try to, there was some bombing going on in the Pacific Ocean that affects the ability of the dolphins to hear. This is actually my dog that died in 2018, Katie. And after Katie died, I started seeing these monarch butterflies everywhere in really profoundly interesting places that made no sense, and so I believe. This is a mourning dove. There was a time when Michigan was considering legislation that would add mourning doves to the game species list. And so Michigan Humane hired me to work in Lansing to try to see if we could make sure that that did not happen. And we were mostly successful. There are a couple counties that were accepted, but for the most part, you can't shoot mourning doves. Interesting, and one of the things that was kind of interesting about that was that it turned out being that Consumers Energy ended up being our greatest ally in this fight. They didn't want their lines shot down. So you never know who your allies are, but think creatively. This is a calf, a veal calf, and that was one of my first protests, was outside of a restaurant that served nothing but veal. This is a chinchilla, and I did some work when I was with one organization and went around the country trying to seek prosecution of fur ranchers for the way that they are killed. It takes about 200 of them to make a coat, and the way that they're killed is something I don't want to repeat. Elephants, obviously, with the circuses, and that fortunately Ringling Brothers has seen the light. I see they're coming through with an all-human animal circus that's coming to Van Andel in Grand Rapids soon, and I just love to see that. That's progress. And this is one of my latest endeavors, is lobsters, working on the way that they're, they're considered sentient beings in Europe, but not here. And so the way that they're killed is obviously problematic. Anyway, so I thought I'd share a little about the stole. Now I'll talk about what it is to be an animal chaplain. So I thought I would, as I put this in the, I was asked to send some readings ahead of time, and so you saw this already, animal chaplains. This is the best way I can describe it. Provide support to both animals and humans by using deep listening and caring companionship. We help animals thrive while living and transition with dignity. We help their human companions move through grief before and after loss by integrating that person's, that human's, secular and spiritual views, whatever they are. In my case, I'll tell you a little bit more about what that means. Specifically, as mentioned, I do blessings of the animals at both secular and spiritual spaces, outdoors and in. I started doing that during Art Prize. Have you all been to Art Prize? Okay. In 2009, I think that was the first year of Art Prize, Mick Carlson is a sculptor who sculpts St. Francis out of bronze. His work is beautiful. If you're ever in Grand Rapids and need a place to just take a walk, the prayer and sculpture path on the Dominican Center property is gorgeous, and you'll see these little 12-inch St. Francis bronze sculptures throughout. He had a life-size St. Francis sculpture in the Waters building, right downtown Grand Rapids, in a building. And how he had it set up is he had like 11 monks, they looked like monks, hooded monks, around St. Francis. And there was a place that you as the observer of the art could step in and hold the hands of the monks and complete the circle. I walked in and he was the only one in there. And I saw his picture on the placard and said, wait, you're the artist. He said, I am. Because you know what would be really great? If we could, I didn't even know him. I mean, we literally had just met. He goes, it would be so cool if I could do, if we could do a blessing of the animals right here inside this building. And so the rest is history. We did a blessing of the animals. We got permission from the Waters building and did it that year and the year after. I think we might have done it 3 years before we moved out to the Dominican Center property and did it outside. But so he and I have been doing those collaboratively for years now. But that's just an example. And I was sharing with Leslie that I did a blessing of the animals at a Jewish synagogue in October of last year. And it was just a very profound experience for me. I did have the rabbi called the night before and said, just to remind you, we're not doing Jesus here. I was like, all right. So anyways, it was lovely. But that's what I do with the blessings. I also do memorial services and funerals, which is that thing that I was trying to do all along. I've done them in backyards. I've done them in living rooms. I've done them in sacred spaces. All those are sacred spaces. Done them in intentional sacred spaces. And then the other thing that I do is I facilitate a grief group once a month, and I've done that for like 15 years now. It's an in-person group, and I'm starting an online group in April, so there'll be an opportunity for more people to take advantage of that. But that has been, and that I have to share, that came out of me calling the Humane Society and asking if I could be on their board, and they said, we really don't need a board, we need someone to facilitate a grief group. Once again, 15 years later, here I am doing this thing that I didn't even know I would be invited to do. The other thing I do is, it sounds weird, but I'm just going to say it. I have kind of a roadkill ministry. I actually keep gloves and a shovel and boxes and bags in my car. I have this little oil called Rescue Remedy that I bring with me. And when I find animals, I will move them off the road. The idea of them continuing to get run over just is horrifying. And I have a place at my house that a tree that I've got, I call it the giving tree, although I'm not really, I read the book again and I'm like, I don't know about that, but nevertheless, it has a good sound. And so I'll leave them, and they're always gone by morning. So it's just another way to care for the bodies of our fellow creatures. So now I'll share, and I have to check my time. I'm not sure how long I have. Okay, perfect. All right, so I'll just briefly talk about spirituality. and the spirituality of animals, which I'm just becoming more and more fascinated with. I felt like it was important to start with a definition, and I think I included this also because it's when we say spirituality, what do we even mean? Our group beforehand was talking about souls and spirits, and what is all that, right? So the working definition that I use is one that was conceived by an author, Sarah Lentz, who got her MDiv at Harvard and works in this area, and her definition is a feeling of connection to something greater or simply connectedness, which is inherently desired and experienced by cultivating a relationship with oneself, one's community, one's environment, and one's orientation with the transcendent. There are two people that are working on brain research around spiritual phenomena, how we experience spirituality. Kevin Nelson is a neurologist, and he's paired with Mark Beekhoff, a colleague of mine who's an ecologist and biologist, and their brain research has determined that that profound spiritual phenomena that we experience is coming from a place in our brain in the limbic system, which is an ancient area of the brain that was formed before the cerebral cortex under which it lies. That structure in the brain, this is just a little bit of science from a non-scientist, is similar in humans and animals, including dogs, cats, and most other animals kept as companions or on farms. Profound spiritual phenomena are those impressions of awe or oneness or mystical unity with something larger, joy, a sense of being dislocated in time. They have also determined that because of these out-of-body and near-death experiences that human beings report, that there's a great likelihood that animals experience those as well. Chimpanzee researcher Jane Goodall was the first to make the claim that this might be possible. If you get a chance, watch the video online of her in the Gombe area with chimpanzees who come out of the brush and experience a waterfall. That is when she started to say there's more going on with them, just based on their responses to the waterfall. Some of you may have seen the viral video last year when a chimpanzee named Vanilla, who was born in captivity and then was in a lab for 28 years, she's been moved to save the chimp in Florida and was allowed to see the sky for the first time. That video, have your tissues ready. It is powerful. So those are, you know, chimpanzees. And it's interesting because my legal and spiritual worlds intersected this year when I was contacted by the Non-Human Rights Project. And they asked me to be local counsel for a lawsuit they filed against a roadside zoo in the UP that has seven chimpanzees in captivity at this time. And one of them, formerly, until just recently, was Tommy, who was featured in the movie Project X with Matthew Broderick many years ago. So after years of use and abuse, Tommy died, and so he's not part of that action, but there are a number who are still there. I did manage to convince the team of attorneys that I'm working with to include language about the spirituality, the potential for spirituality in chimpanzees in our filings. And so it might be the first time that's appeared anywhere. I was so grateful that they were willing to do that. This is a group that are mostly from New York and San Francisco, and it's really not in their realm. Anyway, so because I need to wrap things up, I just want to share that there are a number of experiences that we can talk a little bit more about at the talk back if anybody's interested, looking at the oneness or the mystical unity that animals experience. And I'm going to use my own dogs as an example. I adopted two English shepherds, their twin sisters, Blaze and Ember. I take them to the office with me every day. my law office. And when I get there, Ember goes and she'll sit. She's got a bright pink rug she sits on. And Blaze has her own bed as well. And they both sit there. And when I'm meeting with clients who are in crisis, Blaze gets up and goes and sits and leans. She's a leaner. She'll sit and lean on that person's legs and doesn't move for the entire time. This has been happening for so long that I just went through the West Michigan Therapy Dog Program. And so she graduated last week, and we're going to our first nursing home next week. And we're actually going to be reading with children as well. And so I picked up a bunch of lovely books like The Wonder of Worms, and I'm going to, you know, do this kind of in through the back door with these children and have Blaze read these books about other animals and other creatures. But anyway, so that's another example of just her sense. And I think a lot of people have that sense that their animals know them. They are sensing something that it's hard to explain. And it's just so beautiful. Another that unity, I think, plays out also with grief. Animals grieve. In my group last week, I had someone who had a Daisy dog that died, and her lab is bereft, just walking around the house and not eating. And so I feel like that's a spiritual experience, too, that unity is no longer there. I also have experiences of studies that have been done on these little bush babies, those big-eyed primates. They did a study on intercessory prayer for them. People were literally given, there were 22 in the study, 11 of them were prayed for and the other 11 were not. I believe prayer is an exchange of energy. That's the best way I can describe it. And the ones that were prayed for got better. And there is no explanation. I mean, this is science. And I'm like, all right. We'll do that. Last week, I had an opportunity to speak to Douglas UCC about animals being spiritual messengers. And I think that I did an informal survey to ask people, have you ever had a bird in particular that visited you or someone you know after someone died? I cannot tell you how many responses I had, and they were stunning. I had one friend who had she miscarried twins. They were a male and female babies. And this pair of cardinals, a female and a male, showed up out of nowhere and stayed for weeks, and they're now gone. Another friend had a mourning dove that appeared when her mother died and stayed. Another friend had a father who loved bluebirds and kept seeing bluebirds after he died. And bluebirds aren't that usually common, you know. But my best story of this, and then I'll wrap up, is I read an article that Paul, George, and Ringo, when John had had written a book, a song called Free as a Bird. They got together and recorded this anthology project. This is after John died. And so they're posing for this album cover, and a white peacock came out of nowhere and is just walking behind them. And Paul said, "We knew John was with us." And these are just such beautiful, beautiful things. And I was talking to the group beforehand, and I said, you know, I choose to believe. It's a choice. And I think that we may never know, but I choose to believe that animals have spiritual experiences. I hope some of you will stay and share with me your own experiences and whether or not, and even if you don't agree with me, I'd love to talk some more about this. I would like to close with these words from St. Francis, and I think I forgot to mention Mick Carlson made this for me, and that's why I'm wearing it today, that sculptor. Anyways, it's a St. Francis cross, and this is a poem by St. Francis. It's not what you think it's going to be. It's called Sacraments. I once spoke to my friend, an old squirrel, about the sacraments. He got so excited and ran into a hollow in his tree and came back holding some acorns, an owl feather, and a ribbon he had found. And I just smiled and said, "Yes, dear, you understand everything imparts his grace. Namaste."